Welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do something a little different. We're going to go back to one we started last in April of 2015. We want to do a couple stories by Saki, Hector Hugh Munroe, M-U-N-R-O. And just for a break, for something different. So we'll begin. We did the first few up to page 12 in the introduction. We'll start on page 13. Reginald's choir treat. And remember, Reginald is a sort of a non-homosexual dandy type. Now, a dandy type is someone who would be in love with everything artificial as opposed to natural, who would disdain or affect to disdain the outdoors and grass and bugs and things like that, and would prefer the affected, the stilted, the artificial, the indoors. My point is there's a whole train of associations. There are two sides. There's one side and the other side, and he's definitely on the one side. Reginald's choir treat. Never, wrote Reginald to his most darling friend, be a pioneer. It's the early Christian that gets the fattest lion. Reginald, in his way, was a pioneer. None of the rest of his family had anything approaching Titian hair or a sense of humor. Nancy Drew of Titian hair, or am I wrong about that? And they used primroses as a table decoration. It follows that they never understood Reginald, who came down late to breakfast and nibbled toast and said disrespectful things about the universe. The family ate porridge and believed in everything, even the weather forecast. Ah, that's like Wilde. That's on Wilde's level. It's even. And yeah, I'm not just going to read it. I'm going to throw in my comments as I see fit. So, therefore, the family was relieved when the vicar's daughter undertook the reformation of Reginald. He's épaté le bourgeois. He's scandalizing the middle class in a very light, modest, mild, pleasant, I find, way. And I'm reading from a very cheap Wordsworth edition I got at a used bookstore. I think Park City, around there. They have a whole bunch of outlet stores. And I think that's where I got this many, many years ago, because I got a few of these sort of cheap paperbacks of classics. But anyway, always a little interesting, the provenance of any particular book, I think. And so this is all stuff that was written sort of post-Wilde. Wilde would have died about 1900, but very, very clearly influenced by Wilde. The sort of the form, the general type of wit is it's like a son or a cousin to it. Not quite as good, perhaps, in some ways, but better, perhaps, in others. Let's see, anyway. So, Reginald is not like the rest of his family. The family was relieved when the vicar's daughter undertook the reformation of Reginald. Again, not a faggot. Today, all of these associations would be made to indicate that this person is queer, because they know how to dress and they have emotions and all these things that are denied heterosexuals. They're held to be higher class. But they're not necessarily, just the way irony and wit and even dirtiness or nastiness or filthiness are not foreign to the Aryan or Jewish purely traits. They exist in an aspect or streak of Aryan kind. So, her name was Annabelle. It was the vicar's one extravagance. Annabelle was an accounted beauty, or was accounted a beauty and intellectually gifted. She never played tennis and was reputed to have read Maeterlinck's Life of the Bee. If you abstain from tennis and read Maeterlinck in a small country village, you are, of necessity, intellectual. Also, she had been twice to Fécamp, I have no idea where that is, maybe a place in France or Belgium or something, to pick up a good French accent from the Americans staying there. Consequently, she had a knowledge of the world which might be considered useful in dealings with a worldling. Hence the congratulations in the family when Annabelle undertook the reformation of its wayward member. And this collection is sort of 1,000 3- or 4-page stories, more or less. I exaggerate slightly. It's more like 200 6-page stories. Annabelle commenced operations by asking her unsuspecting pupil to tea in the vicarage gardens. She believed in the healthy influence of natural surroundings, never having been in Sicily, where things are different. And like every woman who has ever preached repentance to unregenerate youth, she dwelt on the sin of an empty life, which always seems so much more scandalous in the country, where people rise early to see if a new strawberry has happened during the night. Now that's a marvelous way of putting it. Equating the appearance of a new strawberry as a happening. And you can hear them talking about it in excited tones as they sit down to eat what he said is their porridge. Reginald recalled the lilies of the field, which simply sat and looked beautiful and defied competition. "But that is not an example for us to follow," gasped Annabelle. "Unfortunately," said Reginald, "we can't afford not to. You don't know what a world of trouble I take in trying to rival the lilies in their artistic simplicity." Again, we hear echoes of Wilde's trying to live up to his blue china. This is how people originate. This is most originality is just like that. He's read that line in Wilde, and he's, well, I can't just outright rip it off, but I can come up with, I'm smart enough, I can come up with a form, and 99.9% of people will not know what I'm doing, and they won't, because they can't read voice or tell these things. You are really indecently vain of your appearance. A good life is infinitely preferable to good looks. You agree with me that the two are incompatible. I always say, beauty is only sin deep. Nearly as witless as something Chesterton would come up with, but also again, cheap, third-rate Wilde. Annabelle began to realize that the battle is not always to the strong-minded. With the immemorial resource of her sex, not gender, sex, she abandoned the frontal attack and laid stress on her unassisted labors in parish work, her mental loneliness, her discouragements. And at the right moment, she produced strawberries and cream. That is, the concrete wins out over the ethereal or the ideal. Reginald was obviously affected by the latter. And when his preceptress, see, there's a nice writerly sort of word, the one who teaches him, that's a fancier word for teacher, suggested that he might begin the strenuous life by helping her to supervise the annual outing of the bucolic infants who composed the local choir, bucolic meaning a fancier word for people who live in rural areas, his eyes shone with the dangerous enthusiasm of a convert. Reginald entered on the strenuous life alone, as far as Annabelle was concerned. The most virtuous women are not proof against damp grass, and Annabelle kept her bed with a cold. Reginald called it a dispensation. It had been the dream of his life to stage manage a choir outing. With strategic insight, he led his shy, bullet-headed charges. That used to be sort of an epithet aimed at Germans, here used to describe English, of course. To the nearest woodland stream and allowed them to bathe. Then he seated himself on their discarded garments and discoursed on their immediate future, which he decreed was to embrace a bacchanalian procession through the village. Forethought had provided the occasion with a supply of tin whistles, but the introduction of a he-goat from a neighboring orchard was a brilliant afterthought, and I like to use that formulation myself, he-goat. It's always funny to apply he or she to some particular animal when you're making fun of something. Very, very good technique. Properly, Reginald explained, there should have been an outfit of panther skins. As it was, those who had spotted handkerchiefs were allowed to wear them, which they did with thankfulness. Reginald recognized the impossibility in the time at his disposal of teaching his shivering neophytes, his beginners, a fancy word there, He recognized the impossibility in the time at his disposal of teaching his shivering neophytes, the kids coming out of the river all freezing and he's on their clothes, a chant in honor of Bacchus, Roman god of grapes and partying. So he started them off with a more familiar, if less appropriate, temperance hymn. So he's got little kids naked singing a temperance hymn, marching through town, blowing on tin whistles. After all, he said, it is the spirit of the thing that counts. Following the etiquette of dramatic authors on first nights, he remained discreetly in the background while the procession, with extreme diffidence, word for shyness, and the goat wound its way lugubriously, my favorite word, ridiculously sorrowfully or mournfully, as their use are deprived of their clothes, towards the village. The singing had died down long before the main street was reached, but the miserable wailing of the pipes brought the inhabitants to their doors. Reginald said he had seen something like it in pictures. The villagers had seen nothing like it in their lives and remarked as much freely. Reginald's family never forgave him. They had no sense of humor. And that, I think, is reasonably funny, without being twee. And these things very easily, English stuff very easily over-exit into tweedom. A tweery. That would be a delightful word, a triple E word, tweery. And that's about the average length of these stories. Let's do a couple more here. Now we have Reginald on worries. "I have," said Reginald, "an aunt who worries. She's not really an aunt, a sort of amateur one, and they aren't really worries. She is a social success and has no domestic tragedies worth speaking of, so she adopts any decorative sorrow. Sorrows that are going, myself included." Right, you like that? Decorative sorrows? Isn't that a good way of putting it? Isn't that a pleasant way? Isn't that a clever way? Isn't that an uncliched way? Isn't it a beautiful way, attractive way, amusing way, provoking way? Decorative sorrows. Jeez, think about all the decorative. How could you slightly reapply that? In other words, decorative sorrows is a different way of putting virtue signaling, right? That's all the rage with the kids and the alt-right and such on Twitter. Virtue signaling. Decorative sorrows, right? Another way of putting the same thing. This is why we read the writing of brilliant men, such as Hector Hugh Munroe. "She is a social success and has no domestic tragedies worth speaking of, so she adopts any decorative sorrows that are going, myself included. In that way, she's the antithesis, or whatever you call it, to those sweet, uncomplaining women, one knows, who have seen trouble and worn blinkers ever since. Of course, one just loves them for it, but I must confess they make me uncomfy. They remind one so of a duck that goes flapping about with forced cheerfulness long after its head has been cut off." I guess ducks are like chicken in that regard. "Ducks have no repose. Now, my aunt has a shade of hair that suits her, and a cook who quarrels with the other servants, which is always a hopeful sign. Now, that's an interesting idea. One would have to think on. And a conscience that's absentee for about 11 months of the year, and only turns up at Lent to annoy her husband's people, who are considerably lower than the angels, so to speak. With all these natural advantages, she says her particular tint of bronze is a natural advantage, and there can be no two opinions as to the advantage. Of course she has to send out for her afflictions, like those restaurants where they haven't got a license. The system has this advantage, that you can fit your unhappinesses in with your other engagements, whereas real worries have a way of arriving at meal times, and when you're dressing or other solemn moments." Notice that he takes dressing very, very seriously as a dandy. Otherwise, that would be irony, but it's not irony because he means it. "I knew a canary once that had been trying for months and years to hatch out a family, and everyone looked upon it as a blameless infatuation, like the sale of Delagoa Bay, which would be an annual loss to the press agencies if it ever came to pass. And one day the bird really did bring it off, in the middle of family prayers. I say the middle, but it was also the end. You can't go on being thankful for daily bread when you're wondering why, what on earth very new canaries expect to be fed on. At present, she's rather in a Balkan state of mind." Billy Joel, New York state of mind. "About the treatment of the Jews in Romania. Personally, I think the Jews have estimable qualities. They're so kind to their poor and to our rich. I dare say in Romania, the cost of living beyond one's income isn't so great. Over here, the trouble is that so many people who have money to throw about seem to have such vague ideas where to throw it. That fund, for instance, to relieve the victims of sudden disasters. What is a sudden disaster? There's Marion Mulciber, who would think she could play bridge, just as she would think she could ride down a hill on a bicycle. On that occasion, she went to a hospital. Now she's gone into a sisterhood. Lost all she had, you know, and gave the rest to heaven. Still, you can't call it a sudden calamity. That occurred when poor dear Marion was born. The doctor said at the time that she couldn't live more than a fortnight, and she's been trying ever since to see if she could. Women are so opinionated. And then there's the education question. Not that I can see there's anything to worry about in that direction. To my mind, education is an absurdly overrated affair. At least, one never took it very seriously at school, where everything was done to bring it prominently under one's notice. Anything that is worth knowing, one practically teaches oneself, and the rest obtrudes itself sooner or later. Excellent use of the word obtrudes, which I use. Most people are not familiar with that word, but William F. Buckley used to use it a fair amount. It's kind of like, I always think of it as like sticking its rear end into what you're doing so that you can't avoid it and you have to deal with it. Obtrudes, intrudes, extrudes. The reason one's elders know so comparatively little is because they have to unlearn so much that they acquired by way of education before we were born. Of course, I'm a believer in nature study. As I said to Lady Bowwhistle, if you want a lesson in elaborate artificiality, just watch the studied unconcern of a Persian cat entering a crowded salon, and then go and practice it for a fortnight. The Bowwhistles weren't born in the purple, you know, but they're getting there in the installment system. So much down, and the rest when you feel like it. They have kind hearts, and they never forget birthdays. I forget what he was, something in the city, where the patriotism comes from, and she, oh, well, her frocks are built in Paris, but she wears them with a strong English accent. So public-spirited of her. I think she must have been very strictly brought up. She's so desperately anxious to do the wrong thing correctly. See, again, here's a fresh departure for thought, which is a phrase from Wilde. She's so desperately anxious to do the wrong thing correctly. Even hints of, like, political correctness, or the way we feel like we're supposed to act in a certain way without thinking about what we're actually doing and the likely outcome of doing, following this particular course. Not that it really matters nowadays, as I told her. I know some perfectly virtuous people who are received everywhere. That would be irony. Now, the irony would be you're supposed to be scandalous or sinful back then. And that, again, is very, very Wildean, that point. We'll do one more. Reginald on house parties. The drawback is, one never really knows one's hosts and hostesses. One gets to know their fox terriers and their chrysanthemums, and whether the story about the go-kart can be turned loose in the drawing room, or must be told privately to each member of the party, for fear of shocking public opinion. See, how wonderful is that? In one sentence, he's described a hell of a lot about human nature. Everyone thinks everyone else will be shocked by something that they are privately delighted to hear. How similar is that to racism? Right? Everyone has the same opinion of niggers, but we can't say it publicly because people would be horrified. Getting others to think that others don't think the way they do, there's a figure called social spiral of silence that can be achieved only in the media. You may harbor private reservations, but you think that everyone else thinks what the media is telling you that they think. That's half the benefit. That's how you get across a minority position and force it on the majority. And he's describing that in non-political terms here. And this is why you learn so much more from reading literature than you do from reading outright psychology. Because if the writer has anything to say, and if he doesn't, he shouldn't be a writer, it comes out in this fiction. And we've already come across in this brief segment four or five things that you could think about for hours. I'll read that again. You get to know their fox terriers and their chrysanthemums, and whether the story about the go-kart can be turned loose in the drawing room or must be told privately to each member of the party for fear of shocking public opinion. But one's host and hostess are a sort of human hinterland that one never has the time to explore. There was a fellow I stayed with once in Warwickshire who farmed his own land but was otherwise quite steady. Again, flipping the conventional that a farmer would be a very steady, stable person. He's implying that farmers are unstable, the opposite of what you'd expect. So you have to stay on your toes. should never have suspected him of having a soul. Yet not very long afterward, he eloped with a lion tamer's widow and set up as a golf instructor somewhere in the Persian Gulf. Dreadfully immoral, of course, because he was only an indifferent player. But still, showed imagination. His wife was really to be pitied, because he had been the only person in the house who understood how to manage the cook's temper, and now she has to put DV on her dinner invitations. Still, that's better than a domestic scandal. A woman who leaves her cook never wholly recovers her position in society. Again, externals matter more than anything else. He's flipping the conventional pieties. I suppose the same thing holds good with the hosts. They seldom have more than a superficial acquaintance with their guests, and so often, just when they do get to know you a bit better, they leave off knowing you altogether. Because you're an asshole. There was rather a breath of winter in the air. Again, the flipping of the conventional. You always hear breath of spring. See, anti-cliché. Women are all about cliché. They're proud to figure out what everyone else is saying. I've hit upon an approved customary verbal formulation. Aren't I a good girl? But the artist is male, and he looks for something innovative, yet not too far ahead that no one can even understand it. Although they do that sometimes, too. But just far enough that you appreciate it, that it's different. You have to be lively, like Wonka walking down the steps. Up, down, up, two, forward, two, back, three, you know? You don't know what he's going to do next, and that's the fun of it. There was rather a breath of winter in the air when I left those Dorsetshire people. You see, they had asked me down to shoot, and I'm not particularly immense at that sort of thing. Isn't that an interesting way of putting it? I'm not real big on that, we would say, but we never heard anyone say, I'm not particularly immense on that sort of thing. You might try it yourself in conversation. There's such a deadly sameness about partridges. When you've missed one, you've missed the lot. Again, note the twist. Taking the customary phrase and swapping out one of the expected. If you've shot one partridge, you've shot them all. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. He says, if you've missed one, you've missed them all. Delightful, right? Different. Unusual, thought-provoking. And they tried to rag me in the smoking room about not being able to hit a bird at 5 yards, a sort of bovine ragging that suggested cows buzzing around a gadfly. Again, the opposite. Gadflies buzz around cows, not cows buzzing around gadflies. And thinking that they were teasing it. So I got up the next morning at early dawn. I know it was dawn because there were lark noises in the sky, and the grass looked as if it had been left out all night. Again, that's almost direct theft from wild. Your hair is quite as nature might have left it. And the grass looked as if it had been left out all night. And hunted up the most conspicuous thing in the bird line that I could find and measured the distance as nearly as it would let me and shoot away all I knew. They said afterwards that it was a tame bird. That's simply silly because it was awfully wild at the first few shots. Afterwards, it quieted down a bit, and when its legs had stopped waving farewells to the landscape, I got a gardener boy to drag it into the hall, where everybody must see it on their way to the breakfast room. I breakfasted upstairs myself. I gathered afterwards that the meal was tinged with a very unchristian spirit. I suppose it's unlucky to bring peacock's feathers into a house. Anyway, there was a blue, pencil-y look in my hostess's eye when I took my departure, so they had some... Do you understand that? They had some peacocks in their garden. He got up at dawn and shot them and then threw them in the hall. And he's affecting not to understand what outraged them. The blue pencil he looked refers to a teacher, like grading a paper. That was how they did it back then, instead of like a red pencil. Probably more near my time or whatever they use today. Some hostesses, of course, will forgive anything, even under pavanicide. There's a beautiful express-built word for the assassination of a peacock. He says, is there such a word? But you know what he means if you're familiar with that root. Pavo in other languages. As long as one is nice-looking and sufficiently unusual to counterbalance some of the others, and there are others, the girl, for instance, who reads Meredith, and appears at meals with unnatural punctuality in a frock that's made at home and repented at leisure. She eventually finds her way to India and gets married and comes home to admire the Royal Academy and to imagine that's where they display all the modern paintings. To imagine that an indifferent prawn curry is forever an effective substitute for all that we have been taught to believe is luncheon. It's then that she really is dangerous, but at her worst she is never quite so bad as the woman who fires exchange and mart questions at you without the least provocation. Imagine the other day, just when I was doing my best to understand half the things I was saying, being asked by one of these seekers after country home truths how many fouls she could keep in a run 10 feet by 6, or whatever it was. I told her whole crowds, as long as she kept the door shut, and the idea didn't seem to have struck her before. At least she brooded over it for the rest of dinner. So he's not interested in animal husbandry. He might be in the country, but he's not of it. Of course, as I say, one never really knows one's ground, and one may make mistakes occasionally, but then one's mistakes sometimes turn out assets in the long run. If we had never bungled away our American colonies, we might never have had the boy from the States to teach us how to wear our hair and cut our clothes, and we must have got our ideas from somewhere, I suppose. Even the hooligan was probably invented in China centuries before we thought of him. England must wake up, as the Duke of Devonshire said the other day, wasn't it? Oh, well, it was someone else. Not that I ever indulge in despair about the future. There always have been men who have gone about despairing of the future, and when the future arrives, it says nice superior things about their having acted according to their lights. It is dreadful to think other people's grandchildren may one day rise up and call one amiable. There are moments when one sympathizes with Herod. Herod is the biblical figure who mass slaughtered the children. Anyway, that will be enough for now. Delightful stuff, I think. You'll agree with me, I hope. That is Hector Hugh Munroe from the Complete Stories of Saki, and we've made our way up to page 17. I'll be with you again real soon.